2002 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents session number 252, A Joyful Life, an interview of Stanley B. Kimball, conducted by Edward L. Kimball.
He's written in fields of Eastern Europe and the Western Movement, and also in the transatlantic, the Trans-Mormon Trail. He's been the president of MHA. He's been the recipient of a Rockefeller Grant. He's a recipient of the best book from Mormon History Association in 1982 and the Arrington Award for historical excellence. He has 4 children and 9 grandchildren, 1 wife, and Valet. People often ask me, so who's your mother, great-grandmother, or how do you come through Hebrew? And I say through Valet Murray, or Valet. And they go, she's your grandma? And they're always referring to her. It takes me a minute to figure it all out. No, it's my cousin. Anyway, and if we have enough time afterwards, she'll debunk any statements by Stan. So we'll take it over. Let Ed take over.
Both Stan and I prefer to sit. I'm sorry if that inconveniences anybody, but we're getting on in years, and this is our preferred posture. Stan and I have been acquainted since I was a teenager, and so was he, just a very few years older than I. Though he doesn't look older than I, he really is. But let's go back to the beginning, Stan, before you and I were acquainted. Tell me where you came from, besides from Heber C. Kimball, which ancestry we share.
Well, I'm proud to be, I was a runny-nosed kid in Farmington, Utah. Born in 1926, and my childhood was idyllic. I go back every chance I get, and I never wanted to leave Farmington. My mother, however, had some other ideas. Anyway, later on, her second marriage was to a son of J. Golden Kimball, Richard Heber Kimball, and eventually we all moved to Denver. And then that was a whole nother world. Here I was, a runny-nosed kid in a town 99.99% Mormon, and pretty soon the next thing I find, I'm in the big city of Denver, where 99.99% of the people were non-Mormons. In fact, I was the only Mormon in my entire junior high school, and there I learned something that, I guess, helped me or guided me throughout my life. It dawned on me that since I was the only Mormon they knew, they would judge the church by me. And that was kind of sobering. So that's the beginning of when I became a terminal nice guy. That was the easiest way to forestall trouble, was to just be a nice guy with a sense of humor and just slough off whatever very clever things they thought they were saying to me. So I learned how to roll with the punches and never really got all that offended. It was just kind of so good give and take, and my what should we say, skill at debate versus theirs. Well, anyway, so that was very happy in my teen years and all. Really, it was just delightful. Well, then I enlisted in World War II in the United States Army Air Force. I didn't do much. I fought the Battle of Shepherd Field, Texas, mainly. And I would have gone to the South Seas, but the atomic bombs of August, of course, ended that. And eventually I was discharged. And then it was time to go on a mission. So I went to what we now call the Czech Republic and got very emotionally involved with those wonderful people. All of us were behind the Iron Curtain, of course, and it was kind of rough. I was shadowed by the secret police and interrogated 2 times by the secret police. But I figured, hey, I'm in the right place at the right time doing the right thing. These guys can't hurt me. And they didn't. They just checked me out and let me go, and I went back to work.
Tell us a little bit about the Czech people and your relationship with them.
Well, kind of a love affair, I guess. I got extremely emotionally involved. That's why I went on to become a professional East Europeanist, because I wanted to study more about them and all of their other Slavic cousins. And there was this, if it wouldn't have been like this, it wouldn't have been an intense experience if, like being in France or Germany, where there was no Communist Party to worry about, when everything you did was monitored. So that made it if not unique, it's certainly a most unusual circumstance.
Place us in the years. When did you go on
mission? 1948 I went, and then after 18 months, our mission was closed.
Why?
Well, they knew we had to be spies, because 19, 20, 21-year-old Americans don't come over here, for hell's sakes, just to preach the gospel. That is their cover, and they are extremely clever because we can never find anything wrong. But we know it's wrong. Now, the reason they tolerated us as long as they did was the hard cash. It wasn't a great deal of money. There were about 50 of us. And you know, in those days, we lived on $50 a month. And I never cooked a meal my entire mission. So we had board and room and transportation and occasional movie and an opera and things like that, all on $50 a month, and thought we were living very high. Well, anyway, that hard currency they desperately needed, but eventually they needed us out more than they needed the hard currency. So then I came home and got a kind of a pathetic M.A.
Wait, we're skipping a little bit here.
Oh.
Did they close the mission down by edict? Or why did you leave specifically?
Well, they had been making noises for about a year that they were going to terminate us, and so we were very careful how we conducted ourselves. And then when they saw that that wasn't working, then they got tough, and they threw two of our men in jail down in the Moravian part of the country. I was up in Prague in the Bohemian province. And so two of our men were in jail on not exactly... They had made a mistake, not a very big mistake, but a mistake big enough so that if the Communist Party wanted to do something, they went ahead and did it. And then they told our mission president, well, we've told you guys we want you out. Now we're going to hold these two men until you leave. It's as simple as that. Well, we got out. And the moment we cleared the Iron Curtain, these two men were put on a plane and flown to Switzerland.
Okay, but you didn't go home then yet, did you?
Oh, no, thanks, Eddie. Then since I only had a year to go, they transferred me to England. Well, fine, that's good. And after my interview with President Stainer Richards, when he found out I was a great-grandson of Heber C. Kimball, he immediately assigned me to Preston, Lancashire, England, because that's where Heber C. Kimball had opened the restoration, not only in England, but in the entire Eastern Hemisphere. Well, I was delighted to go there. Of course, he knew I would work like a very hard to honor my grandfather, great-grandfather, and of course I did. And it was another glorious experience. And then it was time to go home, and then I got this hit-or-miss. We would call it an MFA today, Master of Fine Art. It didn't exist in those days. And finally got a job, a real live job, Ed, one of the first ones I'd ever had. And I went to North Carolina, of all things, to run an art center. And there I met Miss Wright, the wonderful Violet Two. And I kind of felt the Lord said, here, sonny boy, here's the wife for you, and I don't louse it all up. And I guess we haven't, because we're celebrating our 50th next June. So that's the proof of the pudding is in the eating or something. Well, and then it was domesticity of like crazy, kids and all. And then I got tired of planning activities for leisure time women. And I heard about the program on East Central Europe at Columbia. Well, that was for me. I was thinking of a way to leave anyway. So we went off and assaulted the Olympian Heights of Columbia University, and there we lived in genteel poverty for 4 years. Well, I not only took a doctorate in history, but I got what they called a certificate. Excuse me, I'm going to put this in so my mouth doesn't get dry. So forgive me for doing that.
How did you get into Columbia? That's pretty high class school.
Well, now that's a great question, Ed, and I'm so happy. I'm so happy to answer that. And the answer is this: I was totally unprepared for Columbia. And it wasn't long after I was there, I realized, hey, Sonny boy, you have painted yourself into a corner, and you got no place to go. You got to make this because you burned all your bridges behind you. Well, here's how I got into Columbia. I applied from North Carolina, and I'm sure the admissions committee said, oh, well, this guy's not qualified, but he's from North Carolina, and we need geographical distribution. So let's do this. Let's let the guy in. If he flunks out, well, we gave him a chance, and that's that. And that's a fair situation. On the other hand, if by some miracle he makes it, well, that's okay too. And no matter how it goes, we can on our flow chart, we can show that we have people at Columbia from all over everywhere.
I don't believe it, but it's a nice story. You worked hard. You got a PhD plus a certificate, and then went to teaching, right?
After that, I took a job at Southern Illinois University, which is in Greater St. Louis, and as you can see, became rich, wealthy, and famous. So anyway, I taught there 41 years. And then,
why did you go there?
Well, it was a new university, and they were paying $1,000 a year premium to get people to come. So, in other words, money to be rude, crude, and lewd about the whole thing. That's it. But I was a workaholic. And what was really nice is what they wanted me to do was exactly what I wanted to do. So for 41 years, I told anybody who cared that I was well paid to do exactly as I please. And you can't beat that, so I never left.
Now, what were you teaching? People associate you with Mormon history and the Western experience, but you were there for another reason, weren't you?
Well, yes, I was hired to teach modern European history. Sort of with a concentration on East Central Europe. I taught at least one course on that a year. And so that went on, and I was very happy doing that. But after 25 years, I got burned out on East Europe, because East Central Europe, because it is terribly complicated. It's really very rough stuff. And I'd gone back to Prague half a dozen times during this academic experience, but finally they wouldn't let me back anymore. I never could get a visa, so I couldn't get into archives. So I said, well, hell with this. I'll go find somebody else's archives. And lo and behold, there were the church's archives just waiting for me. So I just simply shifted from East Europe to Western America.
Small shift.
Yeah.
Tell us why you couldn't get a visa.
Well, in August of 1968, the Warsaw Pact countries invaded Czechoslovakia and crushed the Prague Spring under Dubček. And as you remember, Dubček was the guy who tried to give communism a human face. And I was there at the time, and it was oh so exciting, because here was a breath of freedom. And people were happy again, and oh, this Prague Spring was a thrilling thing to live through. Then all of us, well, I'll tell you exactly how it happened. I was there to present a paper at the 6th International Congress of Slavists, held every 5 years. Well, as the result of my paper, which I presented before this international congress, the powers that be in the Slovak part of Czechoslovakia invited me down to address the Slovak Academy of Arts and Sciences. So I did. And I got down there, and as I was going to my hotel, I saw that one street was being torn up, and it was just an observation, thought nothing of it. I went to bed, and then during the night, there was all of this racket outside, lots of noise. I said, what in the world are they tearing up the street at night for? Well, I just went back to sleep, and that was the end of that. The next thing I did was walk out, try and rent a car. It was closed, and they went like this, and they kept going like that, and I didn't know what they meant. So I walked down there a block right into the invasion, right into a bunch of tanks and troop carriers. So I spent the entire day photographing, hoping I wouldn't get into trouble, and shot up several rolls of film of the invasion in Bratislava, where very few guys like me were. There were a lot of people in Prague, but I happened to be in Slovakia. Then I hitchhiked out of the country and spent most of the night at Lifetime magazine, offices, reading teletape. What's the word? Teletape? That is the. Huh? Yeah, teletype. And finally went to bed and came home. And went back to work. And
that doesn't tell them yet why you didn't get a visa after that.
Oh, that's right. I handed all of my film to Life and Time, and they gave me a whole $60 for it. And then in Time, they published one of my better photographs of the Czechs defying a Russian tank. Well, that was monitored, of course.
And is it by a credit?
Yeah, it was a credit line with my name right down there at the bottom. And so they monitored that, and that put me once again, I'd been there several times, once again right on the blacklist, and that was the beginning of the end. So then I'd always studied Mormon history, so moving to Western American history wasn't much of a job. And I've been very happy doing that ever since, for the past 20 years.
Did you teach Mormon history as such in St. Louis, in southern Illinois?
Well, no. There was never a class called Mormon history. It was just the Mormon dimension of the westward movement, which is a very incidentally, that gets bigger all the time. Even in your high school textbooks, there's always a chapter on the Mormons in the West. It, you know, we are becoming really quite respectable.
Now, you did a great deal of publishing about Eastern Europe and about the Slavic countries. Is that right?
Yes, I enjoyed the highest aspiration a graduate student has, and that is to have their dissertation published. So my dissertation, which was on the Czech National Theater, was published by the University of Illinois Press. My press wasn't interested. I said, well, I'll go elsewhere, and got a much better imprimatur with the U of I press. Incidentally, they've published about four of my books over the years, and they have this marvelous, terrific Mormon series that I hope you folks are familiar with.
Okay, Stan, then, did you stop teaching European history and shift to American history?
Yes, I haven't taught European history for 20 years.
Okay. And what courses, you said the Mormon dimension of Western American history is something like that?
Yeah.
Did you teach other courses related? What names would you give to the courses? Or were they all the same
courses? I'd hold an occasional seminar on that subject, an occasional 500 course on it, a methods course where I would assign the entire group to work on the Mormons going west. And nobody ever gave me any static. They just willingly settled down and...
Were you identified as the Mormon professor?
Yes, I was.
Is that for good or for ill?
Well, you see, I think I already mentioned that I became terminally nice back in junior high, and I just kind of stayed terminally nice. And it was sort of a contest of sorts to see if anybody could ruffle me by talking about polygamy or the temple or the word of wisdom or whatever. But I refused to be ruffled and just gave them fairly humorous answers when I could think of. Oh, there's one story I want to tell you, Ed, that comes out of that. When I was at Columbia, I needed a job, and I was teaching at CCNY, College of the City of New York, but I needed more money, so I tried to get a job teaching at Columbia. Well, nobody ever became an instructor at Columbia if they hadn't passed their orals, but I did. And here's an object lesson for all of you, for everybody. Let me tell you what happened. One of my professors just loved to kid me about Mormonism in any way he could think up. And I'd always roll with the punch and laugh and this, you know, and we just had a good old time and let it go at that. Well, he was a big boozer. He drank like a fish, and he always kept a lot of alcohol in his locked filing cabinet in his office. And he was a sociable guy, and he had the habit of inviting his fair-haired boys and some faculty members into his office after almost anything, and they'd sit around and drink for a while, and he invited me. He knew I didn't drink. He invited me for comic relief, because while I was there, he could show off to everybody and ask me all of these dumb questions, you know. Well, once again, I just rolled with the punch and laughed as much as they laughed. Well, it just so happened that the guy who was in charge of instructors, of student instructors at Columbia, came to those same parties. Well, he knew that everybody that was there was a fair-haired boy of this professor. He didn't know that I was there for comic relief. So when I went to him and said, can we rethink this job thing, I got the job on the basis of a colossal misunderstanding. So guys, be nice. Don't let anybody rattle you. Just give and take. And keep your smiles and all of that.
Stan, if you're identified with any one thing broadly, I think it is sort of the Trails West. Tell us about how you got involved in that.
Well, okay, we moved to Illinois, to Southern Illinois, in 1959. And I couldn't wait to take my family to Nauvoo, so we went to Nauvoo. And then over the years, we'd go to Nauvoo about every year. Then we went to the historic sites in Missouri and one thing and another. And then a friend of mine decided he wanted to do a book called Guide to Historic Mormon America. And he wanted me to do a chapter. Well, I looked at his proposal and said, I don't want to do a chapter. I want to do the whole thing. So he said, fine, go and do the whole thing. So 90% of that book, which is still in print in its 22nd edition, some of you may have it, it's unbelievable the success of that thing, because 90% of it I wrote at my desk. I just got a pile of books and maps and wrote a guidebook of historic Mormon America.
You hoped it was really there.
Yes. And then after it was all over and the book started to sell, I said to my friend, hey, let's go look at this stuff. This is really interesting. So I was undaunted, and like I say, it's still in print. And then what was the rest, Ed?
Well, you got into that really almost as a sub-career.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. Then... Then what really got things going was in 1974, the Bureau of Outdoor Recreation, which no longer exists, of the Department of the Interior, went to Salt Lake and said, we want to study the Mormon Trail to develop it recreationally. Will you help us? Well, now there, that's quite a civilized approach for the government, to come in and said, will you help us? We want to do this job right. Well, the church said we most assuredly will. And to make a long story short, I drew the short straw and I was given the assignment. Well, I crawled all over the trail, took hundreds of pictures and anyway, maps and all that stuff and turned in the study. And everybody was very happy with all of that. And I didn't get anything for it. They didn't even credit me with tithing and kind. But I was happy, and then I got hooked. And then I spent since 74 until, well, today after a fashion, the Mormon Trail. First of all, I insisted that not just do the Nauvoo to Salt Lake. That's the trail that's been done to death. So I started looking around, and pretty soon I found a dozen trails used by the Mormons. Now, I have to define, if one Mormon used one trail, to me that's a Mormon trail. So I was able to write a book on all of this stuff, which came out in 1979, when absolutely nobody could have cared less. In 79, Deseret Book printed 10,000 copies, and it went OP. It went out of print. But anyway, one thing led to another, and so I started more and more publishing, and people got more and more interested, and local societies sprung up along the line. And this is the one, this is a terribly important point. The one thing I learned real quick was if you approached living people today living along the trail, if you approached them in a nice manner, and that's the benefits of being a terminally nice guy, they'll fall all over themselves to show you this, and they'll drive you there and show you all kinds of stuff that only locals knew. So I was able to do that, and I very quickly discovered that, yeah, this is Mormon stuff, but it's our history too. This is Iowa history. This is Nebraska history. This is Wyoming history. And so I just had this marvelous relationship with the contemporaries along the trail. And they were terribly supportive. And they're the ones that, like, for example, there's the Iowa Mormon Trails Association, the Nebraska Mormon Trails Association, all got up with a little help from us by locals. And they're still out there looking around and erecting markers and signing and all kinds of things. And it just became a way of life. And I think I can succinctly end this, Ed, by saying that my attraction, my devotion, my whatever to Mormon trails is the trails were like, to be serious for just a moment, for once, in my presidential address before the Mormon History Association, I said that Mormon trails to me were like a linear temple. It was just here was the past, and it was, and another, I'm going to give you another quote here that I've copyrighted this, but you can use it. The power of place and the spirit of locale. And I was never happier than when I was up on some promontory and could look farther and see less than any place else. It was so easy to get away from the hand of man. Things looked a lot like, I presume they did, when my great-great-grandfather went out, back, and out. So he was on the Mormon Trail three times, you see, 47 and 48.
Were you recruited to be a guide for other people, or was this all on your own?
Let me see. I took a photographer, an ensign photographer, over the trail twice, once by fixed-wing plane, once by car. I took a National Geographic writer over the trail. I took a guy who was writing a book on it over the trail. And then in 1979, maybe something like that, the Sons of Utah Pioneers held a relay race. It just seemed the thing to do, and I had to lay out the trail with red stakes, you know, because people would run 10 miles and another person would run 10 miles and so on. So I got to do that. And then once for the Deseret News, they did a whole series of articles in 19-something or other. And I took one of their writers, Hal Knight, perhaps the name means something to somebody, a Deseret News guy, and we went over it. So yeah, and the Bureau of Land Management. And then the Corps of Engineers. Remember when they were redoing the, what's this reservoir up here? It's not Strawberry. It's the one that closer to town, reservoir. What?
Little Dell. There's.
Yeah, that's it, Mountain Dell. Well, anyway, before, this is an interesting story. Before that dam got, while they were building the dam, they wanted somebody to go in and check all the historic whatever sites and one thing and another in the area which would be inundated when the dam was in full operation. Well, there were 10 people in Salt Lake that in Utah, maybe more, could have done that, but for some reason they came clear to Greater St. Louis to get me to do it. And I said, well, if the price is right, I'll be right there. Well, they said, how does 5,000 sound? I said, I'll be there. And so I had a lot of fun doing that, and I absolutely insisted, however, up front, you must give me one helicopter ride over there, because it's just necessary to do it. And so they did. And I had the great thrill of flapping around in a helicopter over the Mountaindale Dam area. And then anent that, you guys all saw Trail of Hope, didn't you? Well, I was their talking head and guide on that particular thing. Oh, that was a thrill. But then once again, Lee Groberg and Bountiful did it. I insisted, Lee, I said, that now you got a chance to crank out just another common
documentary,
or you got a chance to do something that will actually live. And I said, that translates out as a helicopter. Well, helicopters charge several hundred dollars an hour. And my great friend Lee Groberg does not throw money around. As I could tell you some real interesting stories about that. One time he sent me the manuscript to critique it in a $50 check. And I wrote right back, thanks, Lee, I appreciate your offer. I will be happy to critique your signature for this $50. So we Indian wrestled for a while and came up with a very a very handsome figure. But anyway, where was I?
We're going over the trails. Were there church people that were involved in, did they have an interest, general authorities?
Oh, well, yes. In 1974, after I did that study for the Bureau of Outdoor Recreation, C. Booth Wallentine, who used to be and maybe still is director of the Utah Farm Bureau. Does that mean, can anybody verify that? Well, anyway, C. Booth Wallentine was very interested in all of this. And what was the question?
About church people.
Oh, yes. And we went to report to Elder Hinckley, not President Hinckley, but Elder Hinckley. And so we kept him advised on all that we were doing and all of that. So that was my main contact with the hierarchy.
Violet said there was an embarrassing incident. Have you forgotten that? On the trail?
Oh. Well, getting back to how nice everybody was on the trail, if you were nice to them and respect it, you see, you gotta respect people's privacy. You gotta respect their land. You just don't walk right in and say, "Well, I'm a Mormon, so I can, you know, and I can get away with all this." And what do you care? No, you go to the front door. You briefly explain what you want to do. May I have your permission to walk down there, or whatever? Usually, they'll walk down there with you. Well, anyway, to get on with it, I was right on the frontier, as I insist on saying, of Utah. up near Cache Cave, up near the Needles, up near Bear River, where you're not very far from the Wyoming-Utah state line. Well, just about that time, for some reason, I got an attack of Montezuma's Revenge, the Texas Two-Step, or a lot of other things. Diarrhea is what it is, if you insist. And there were no trees, there were no bushes, there was no nothing. So I was desperate. There was a farmhouse. And nobody would do what I did unless they were desperate. I knocked on the door, and this nice lady came, and I said, "Ma'am, please forgive me, but I'm in trouble, and mind I use your restroom?" Well, she was a nice, lovely thing, so she said, "Certainly." And when I came out, she says, "You've got diarrhea, haven't you?" "Yes, ma'am." She said, "Would you like to get rid of it?" I said, "Yes, ma'am." She went to the cupboard and poured me a shot glass of peach brandy and handed it to me. And I said, "But ma'am, I don't drink." And she said, "I didn't ask you if you drank or not. I asked you if you wanted to get rid of your bowel complaint. Drink it." So I drank it. And I will never know whether it was the shock to my system or what it was, but it ended. I was cured.
I think we're all glad for that advice. We may need it.
Well, it's a good excuse anyway.
Stan, you've read trail journals more perhaps than anybody else. Characterize them for us. What did you learn by reading the trail journals that we haven't assumed already?
Well, oh, that's a great question. Well, I have, to be serious again for a moment, I have annotated 1,200 Mormon journals, mostly trail-related, but not exclusively. And what did I find? Well, I found all kinds of marvelous things, but I found that some of the journals listed nothing but the weather and how many miles. It was as interesting as a Turkish tax list. So there was this little pile, you know, of stuff that was obviously done out of a sense of duty. Well, I appreciated that, but I didn't learn very much. And then it went all the way from that humble beginning, kind of like a crescendo, up to some real works of art where people waxed quite eloquently and told some beautiful and some utterly tragic stories. Anything and everything that you could imagine turns up in these journals. Now, the thing perhaps that I should underscore here is I was raised, as most of you I presume, that our ancestors came into the valley in 47 to 69 trailing clouds of glory, and that they were super saints and deserving in every way of our respect. Well, all of that is true. I'm not taking anything away from that. But I got to tell you, page 2, you know, the other side of the story. Our beloved heroic ancestors were a cross-section of humanity in just the way that any Mormon congregation today is not made up of all holy saints. They're the cross-section of humanity. Well, that's the way I think it ought to be. And so I discovered all kinds of negative things, like for example, in the hand cart, there were these young people and their mother and father were just about dead from exhaustion and cold and everything. And so they scratched up a few little limbs and things and made a little fire and was going to make some tea for their mother and their father. Well, just at that time, the leader of the handcart company called for prayer. And they said, "Well, please excuse us this time because we're trying to help our parents out." Well, according to the journal, the captain kicked the fire out with his food and said, "Prayer comes first." Well, there was that, and there was a lot of hanky-panky, incidentally. People don't want to get into that, but there was plenty of hanky-panky going on, and there was fighting with knives and horse whips, and there was drinking. One guy, his wife was in charge of the wagon for a while, and he was out doing something else, and she let the wagon tip over, and out came a keg of whiskey that he had hidden in the bottom of his wagon, and he was furious, of course, at his wife for revealing this secret. Well, there was lots of that. And as far as medication is concerned, this will curl your hair, but Heber C. Kimball took a bottle of brandy and blessed it to the good of those who had illness. Now, when I was a missionary, perhaps you've heard this apocryphal story, this urban legend, that two elders once decided to consecrate a bottle of beer, and they did it, and they were struck dumb. Well, that's an urban legend, but this other one was not an urban legend.
How would you characterize the journals as a whole, recognizing that there are people at both extremes and probably all along the spectrum?
Yes.
Overall, what would you say they represented?
Oh, I never thought of that question, Ed. I guess I'll have to stumble around and come back to this cross-section of humanity. Some of them were very, how should we say, positive, and others were quite realistic, and some were very long and some were short. I'm not sure I know just how to answer that right now.
Did they reflect faith? Did they reflect going west for better opportunities in the desert?
Oh, well, yes, they did that. Not many decided to put in writing their negative feelings. There was plenty of negative feelings. You see, here's something that maybe you know and maybe you don't know. By the time you got to winter quarters, by the time you got to the Mississippi River, you could decide to quit in relative safety.
You're talking the Missouri River.
Missouri River. I love to refer to the Mormon trek between the Mississippi River and the Missouri River, and I call it the Mormon Mesopotamia. Don't you think that's grand?
This is across Iowa.
Yeah, yeah, across Iowa. Fill me in again. What are we talking about?
That's fine. Let's go on to something else.
Well, well, I can't ignore my wife, so a couple of years ago, I was invited, along with President Hinckley, to be at the dedication of the restored Simpson's Hollow marker in western Wyoming, about 20 miles west of Farson. Nobody's ever heard of Farson, but it's not close to anything, so just trust me, it's out there in the middle of nowhere. And so I wrote a letter to President Hinckley saying that I had the honor of sharing the podium with him, and I did not want to use the material that he was going to use. So I said, this is what I'm going to do unless you're going to do it. Please advise. Well, I never got an answer, nothing. So as time was running out, I phoned him, but of course all I got was a secretary. So I told the secretary this, and I said, please, I could be very embarrassed over this. Did President Hinckley get my letter? What does he want me to do or not do? And she insisted that he got my letter. She insisted he was working on his talk right then and there. And I said, well, that's fine, but I don't want to walk all over his paper, because obviously I would speak first. She said, no, everything's fine. Well, I got up, I seen my duty, and I done it. And then when President Hinckley got up, he said, well, Stan's told all of the stories I was going to tell you. And didn't talk very long, and I was absolutely mortified since I had gone to significant effort to prevent just that. But I'm sure he's long since forgiven me. You see, I have something that you guys don't have. I used to refer to President Hinckley as Brother Gordon, because he and I went to Sunday school in the Denver First Ward for a long time. So I knew back when.
Stan, thinking back over your long career and the publications in Eastern European history and in church history and travel west and all, what are publications of which you are the fondest, the most content that you spent your time on them?
Well, in East Europe, I published quite a bit, and perhaps, that's a good question, by the way, I never thought of it. But anyway, I'll improvise an answer. I think I was proudest of a book with the marvelous title of Literary Foundations among the Austro-Slavs in the 19th century.
Is it an immortal title?
Well, the reason I'm proud of it is that when I was a Slavist, I was a pretty good Slavist. And I had to stumble around in 13 languages to do this particular book. But in those days, to fit in this with your question, my great goal in life, my great hope, was to qualify myself in Slavic and East European affairs, languages, history, culture, economic, all that sort of stuff abroad, is because I had been there and I had been kicked out. And I wanted to qualify in every way possible to be on the front wave of church people who, when we would finally get back, when the Iron Curtain would finally part and we could move in, I figured we better move in fast and strong, so I'm going to be all ready. Well, I spent an awful long time turning myself into a Slavist, and nobody knew. I never got a postcard. On that, that's one of my great, one of these questions is the greatest disappointment professionally. Well, that was it. So anyway, nothing happened. But the Lord knows what I was doing, so who cares, you know.
Any other favorite books?
So I did this book on Austro-Slavs because it involved all of the Slavic peoples, you see, and gave me my edge, shall we say, if the church ever needed me. Well, then in Mormon history, I guess my favorite book, most successful one anyway, is the biography I did of my great-great-grandsire, Heber C. Kimball. And incidentally, I wrote Heber C. Kimball during Camelot. That's historians' talk for when Leonard Arrington was in charge of the archives. Everything was absolutely wide open, and I was right there to make the best of it. In fact, Violet and I, we spent a whole sabbatical. I was given an office in the church historian's office to do. That's when I read most of these 1,200 journals and took notes and all that sort of stuff. Anyway, what?
Favorite book.
Oh, yes. I said, I'm going into polygamy as deeply as I can to find out what that stuff was really all about, and I did, and some of it will curl your hair. And then I'm going as deeply as I can into masonry to see just what there is there. And after that, then I got into Brigham Young's distillery records, which I'd have one hell of a time getting into today, I can tell you. But I got into Brigham Young's distillery records, and I immediately turned to the Kimball family, and they were pretty good customers.
Then it was all medicinal.
Oh, yes, of course.
We're running short of time, but I want you to talk a little bit about when we first got acquainted. You remember?
Oh, as I recall, it was at my wedding.
Just before that.
Just before that?
Yeah. Why? Why was I at your wedding? I'm asking really about your relationship with my father.
Oh, yes. Oh, my. That was one of the greatest things in my life was Eddie's dad. I was 17. He had just become an apostle, and I was living in Denver, but I was out in Salt Lake two or three times every year. Anyway, I was out here, so being brash and, you know, like 17 years old, I phoned and got an appointment with Elder Kimball, and for some strange reason, he gave me an appointment, and so I went in, and he was working on genealogy, and he was having trouble with one family, so I looked at it, I said, oh, that's my grandmother's family, she knows all about that, would you like me to phone her, because she was here at the time, so I phoned my wonderful grandmother, got all of the information that Spencer Kimball needed for this particular genealogical problem, and that kind of made me his fair-haired boy, but during this time, I would call him Elder Kimball, I would call him Brother Kimball, I would call him Apostle Kimball. In other words, I was floundering all over the place because I wasn't sure how to address him. Well, when I started calling him Apostle Kimball, he said, well, Stan, now wait a minute, that's a holy title. You really shouldn't call me that. "Would you like to call me Uncle?" Oh. Oh, I said, "May I?" I mean, that was it. I couldn't imagine anything higher than that. And so this dear, wonderful man became Uncle Spencer until he died. And I took such terrible liberties. I wrote him all kinds of letters on how the church should be run. And that we should be honest about the word of wisdom. And isn't it time to redraft the temple text so that we don't have lions and tigers and bears, oh my, and all this endless repetition that I don't really know what's going on because I'm just hearing everything three times. Well, eventually they did do that. But when Ed's working on Eliza, his father, I'm sure it's already completed. And I had to confess to Ed when he was asking me some questions that I had certainly taken terrible advantage of his dad, and I don't know how he put up with it. And Ed made some very soothing remarks that made me feel a whole lot better.
I'll take liberties to read to you a couple of paragraphs from the forthcoming book. Stanley B. Kimball, Heber's biographer and Spencer's cousin twice removed, grew up without a father. He reminisced nostalgically that when he was just 17, Spencer offered to be his Uncle Spencer. Over the years, Stan recalls, he had amazingly open access. Whenever he came to Salt Lake City, he could get an appointment no matter how busy Spencer was, and their visits were never rushed. Spencer gave him personal and professional counsel, listened non-judgmentally when Stan freely gave advice on how the church should be run. Spencer loaned Stan his car, took him to lunch, answered his numerous questions, provided access to documents for his biography of Heber C. Kimball. Stan relates that Spencer confided how much he yearned for more expressions of appreciation from some of his children. Once, to maximize visiting time, Stan stood in the bathroom door talking while Spencer shaved. Another time, Stan, in military uniform, met Spencer in Denver, and they slept in the same bed, although Stan could have returned to the base for the night. Spencer read and complimented Stan on his publications, sometimes even offering corrections on his manuscripts. Stan, whose missionary service in Czechoslovakia and graduate study in Eastern European studies stimulated ideas for reopening missionary work in Eastern Europe, He found an attentive listener in Spencer who also referred him to David Kennedy. Learning of Spencer's 1979 hospitalization, Stan wrote, As much as you mean to me as president and prophet, I value far, far above that the role you played as a surrogate father to me since I was a most mixed up 17-year-old. Presidents and prophets come and go. But you, Uncle, have played a unique role in my life. Thanks for...
Oh, Eddie, I'm glad to hear that.
The time's nearly gone. You'll want to sum up and tell these people what we haven't asked you about, but you really want to say to them after a long life of commitment in the church and study of the church's history. And
I guess I'll sum it up this way. I told you I was a runny-nosed kid in Farmington, Utah, who was childhood was a fairy tale and happy. Somebody called this panel a life of joy or something. I don't know exactly where that came from.
Here it is.
A joyful life. Well, with just enough troubles, know what life is all about. I've had my share of troubles, but when all is said and done, I've had a great life, a great professional, great supportive wife. Oh boy, my wife has never kept me from doing anything. In 49 plus years of marriage, there isn't a thing I wanted to do that she didn't cooperate with me. And so I just want to acknowledge that publicly. I've told her that, of course, myself. And so I guess I'm just a lucky guy and have enjoyed life and each day My days are numbered, by the way, and but every day I get up, and one day, I mean, each day is very special.
Not everybody knows your condition. Do you mind telling?
I'll do it this way. Here's my position. Mark Twain. Mark Twain said, "The best way to live to a ripe old age is to get an incurable disease and take good care of it." Well, I have incurable cancer and I'm taking very good care of it. Or as one person said to me last night when I said, "Hell, brother, how are you?" He says, "Well, I'm perfect, but I'm getting better." So that's me. Now, any time for questions?
Yeah, just enough time for maybe one question. Anybody? Go ahead, Stan.
A few years ago, you did an article on the Ensign about Joseph Smith and the Kinderhook plates.
Yes.
Can you tell us what you believe Joseph Smith did with the first Adventist?
Okay, since time is out, I'll have to go through this. But anyway, about a year before the prophet was assassinated, some frontier jokesters down in Kinderhook, it's called the Kinderhook Plates because there was a little jerkwater town called Kinderhook, they faked some axe heads and etched them with acid all over the place and planted them and then dug them up in the presence of witnesses and all, and anybody said, "Well, old Joe Smith can translate those." So they were taken to old Joe Smith, and we don't know what. All we know about what happened is in William Clayton's journal. William Clayton said Joseph looked at them and declared that they were about a descendant of Ham, and he would get around to translating them maybe sometime. Well, by the time sometime came, the prophet was dead, and the plates, the Kinderhook plates, went back to Kinderhook, and we were so busy getting ready to go west that the whole thing was totally forgotten. But then after we're out west, some of these same jokesters come up again with this, and they say, "Well, see, Joseph Smith is a fallen prophet. He wasn't able to translate these things." Well, we eventually, and the arguments went on back and forth, decade after decade after decade, and I got interested in it because I lived in Illinois and because I'd been to this little jerkwater town called Kinderhook several times. So to make a long story short, I noticed that all of the research that had been done on this, they had never done what are known as destructive tests, where they knock off a minute piece and check it under electronic microscopes and all kinds of razzle-dazzle metallurgy. Somehow I was able to talk the Chicago Historical Society. There were six of these things and only one is extant, and it was in the Chicago Historical Society. And I went there, and being terminally nice and all of that, somehow they actually allowed me to take that thing out, take it back to my office, and get a metallurgical specialist to analyze it. So I phoned Northwestern University, Department of Metallurgy, told them what I was going to do, and I needed a recommendation of a qualified metallurgist. He said, "We just happen to have one, and he's Mormon too." I said, "Well, don't hold that against him, but give me his name and all of that." So to make a long story short, I had this absolutely pure scientific stuff done by a colleague and a member of the church and all of that. And then he was able to prove that it was a fake. So one night he called me and said, "Stan, I don't know what to do. It's a fake." I said, "Just tell the truth." And so he did, and I did. And that thing bit the dust, and they had to remove it from exhibit at Nauvoo Restoration Incorporated. And so I eloquently summed the whole thing up, that now is the time to take the Kinderhook plates and tenderly place them on the breast of the Cardiff giant and forget the whole miserable story.
Thank you very kindly. We're done.